Welcome back. We have a small group today. I know Akanka is not feeling well, and Elaine couldn't make it, and Kit and Clay went to the Wednesday group instead this week. So it's just us. So today we are moving on to another author. Is there anything left over from last week that you still had a question about or wanted to say, or did you have any dreams about Wendell Berry? Or I worry about you if you did. But okay, so we will move on to Rhianne Eisler. I'll pass this around. Rhianne Eisler was born in Vienna, in Austria, in 1931. And when she was a young girl, of course, that was just when the Nazis were moving into Austria, and her family was Jewish, and her father was taken. They were able to get him back somehow, and then they got out of Austria as quickly as they could. So in 1938, they emigrated and came to Cuba, of all places. And I don't know how long they were there, but Eisler came to the U.S. at some point after that, went to the Los Angeles area, got her law degree and a graduate degree in sociology at UCLA. And in the 60s and 70s, she was a pioneering thinker in the women's movement. So she wrote a book about the Equal Rights Amendment, which, as you remember, was a big issue at that time and didn't get passed. But she wrote about that. She also wrote about no-fault divorce, which was a kind of a breakthrough at that time. So she was writing about women's law and women's studies and was a pioneer in those areas, but wasn't really well known until 1987. And that's when her book, The Chalice and the Blade, was published. She had been doing research on the history of civilizations going way back. There was some new research coming out in archaeology, particularly from areas of Turkey, where they and Greece, where they were looking at some ancient civilizations and learning some new facets about them. And she took this research and said that it demonstrated that civilizations aren't always hierarchical and violent and male dominated, that these early civilizations showed great evidence of being much more egalitarian, gender roles were much less rigid, and they were nonviolent societies. And so she wondered how could we do that again? If we've had civilizations like that once before, first of all, why did they get changed into what we've had pretty much ever since, and how could we reclaim that? So that was the essence of her argument in The Chalice and the Blade. And it really struck a chord. It was translated into 26 languages. And the famous anthropologist Ashley Montague, who was quite a public intellectual back in the 80s, I don't think we remember him much today, but he said that Chalice and the Blade was the most important book since Darwin's Origin of Species. Wow. So that's quite a recommendation there. Her book is not widely known today, but there is a certain following, I would say, who do still consider her work quite groundbreaking, quite important. In the 30 years since the book came out, she has been working really diligently to promote the ideas that she explained there. And of course, we'll all get into the details today. But she's written several more books. She started a Center for Partnership Studies, which publishes a journal. She has formed networks of activists. She's worked with people like Desmond Tutu in South Africa and other leaders in various aspects of society. In the year 2000, she came out with a book called Tomorrow's Children and talked about how her ideas applied to education. And this put her on a collision course with me, because I was working in this field, and I don't remember where we first made contact, but in 2000 or 2001, she held a big conference in Tucson to try to build a partnership education movement. So I went to that, and we started collaborating. And one of our projects together was a book called Educating for a Culture of Peace. So I'll pass that around.
Here's your picture.
On the back. It's published by an educational press that's not that well known called Heinemann. So it's not a book that you would have heard of before. But so we did that. We brought Eisler to Goddard College soon after that and started a partnership education concentration. Not many students, but some were interested in studying her work. So I know her pretty well. We've been collaborating. Nan Bourne actually knows her. Nan lived in Carmel, where Rianne lives, and did some work with her many years ago. So that's kind of interesting. One more thing I'll say about her biography: the fact that she experienced the rise of Nazism and actually had firsthand close-up experience with that is one of the driving forces in her life. She has made it her mission to try to understand what makes that kind of evil possible. Why do we have...
Do you have any insights on today?
I think so, which is why we're including her in this course. She wants to understand, is this natural? Is this part of human nature, or what? Are we doomed to suffer this kind of evil, or is there a way we can work with it or work against it? So that's what her work is about. All right, so let's talk about the content of her work. I keep using this term partnership, and that's because the central part of her idea, her work, is a continuum of cultural possibilities, and the two poles of that continuum are dominator and partnership. Those are the extremes. So a culture or civilization that's oriented toward domination will have certain characteristics, and a culture that's oriented toward partnership will have opposite characteristics. And she says there's no pure example on either end. Although I guess with Nazism you get pretty close to the extreme, but that most cultures are some blend. But you can still try to identify where on that continuum a culture is. So we'll be talking a lot about dominator and partnership. But she wants to get this point across more than anything. This is a quote. What we think of as natural and inevitable, destructive personal and social patterns, such as domestic violence, chronic warfare, racial and religious prejudice, the domination of women by men, are not natural or inevitable at all. So that's her conclusion after these years of study, that we don't have to settle for that, because it's not normal, it's not inherent that societies be that way. And then she goes on, certainly the human capacity for violence is genetically based, but our capacity for caring and peaceableness is also genetically based. So we have both possibilities. The question is, which of those are we going to express? She argues that evolution, biological evolution, actually favors caring and empathy and collaboration. And in fact, her husband, whose name is David Loy, L-O-Y-E, has written about Darwin and makes the argument that this mythology about Darwin, the survival of the fittest and nature red in tooth and claw and strident competition is really the essence of biological survival. He said that's all wrong. That's not what Darwin was teaching. Darwin actually spoke more about collaboration and caring as the engines driving evolution, especially human evolution. And so why do we think of Darwin as being such a having such a nasty view of human nature? That came about in the late 19th century because apologists for laissez-faire, for unfettered competition and capitalist dominance, like Herbert Spencer, took Darwin's ideas and interpreted it that way. That's the story they told about Darwin, and it stuck. So our culture, which Eisler would say is largely a dominator culture, uses Darwin and other theorists for its own purposes. And she says, she, like her husband, says that's not what evolution really is about. We really have more reason to be caring and collaborative than we do to be violent. So the brutal violent side of human nature, those kinds of traits are not something we have to tack on to a brutal and callous human nature. I believe all of us are born with an inner voice that tells us to be caring, not cruel, and that is the essence of what makes us human. So that's the basis of her philosophy. And she explains more. All of these capacities are part of our genetic repertoire, but genetic capacities are not automatically expressed. Gene expression or inhibition is a function of the interaction of genes with experience. And since for humans, experience is primarily shaped by culture, to understand what genetic possibilities will be expressed or inhibited, we have to move to an examination of what kinds of cultures produce experience that facilitate or inhibit our genetic potential for caring and creativity or for cruelty and destructiveness. Every culture will have some violence. But the real issue is whether a culture institutionalizes, systematically teaches, and even idealizes violence. So that's the key point of her work. So there's an ongoing debate in philosophy, in philosophical circles, of nature versus nurture, right? Like what really shapes who we are as human beings? And there are legitimate points of view that say, no, it's our biology, it's our genetic inheritance, it's nature. And there's not a whole lot we can do about that. And Eisler begs to differ with that point of view. She says, sure, there's potential for all these various behaviors, but really it's the culture that's going to, in the last analysis, is going to determine what kind of people we are. So if you hold that point of view, then you're going to have more faith in education and in the power of a society to make decisions, whether through government or philosophy and other institutions, but we have the power to shape who we are. That's the basis of her teaching. Want to say anything about that? Unconscious. I think that's your point. Yes. We culture lives through us. There are cultural memes, the sort of ways of understanding, ways of defining what's real that we don't think about. That's just how reality is for us. And what she is saying is that if we can name those things, if we can become more intentional, to use your term, that's how we change. So culture does have momentum of its own, has an inertia of its own, and it shows up in mass hysteria or all kinds of ways. But if we can step back and name what's going on here, why are we acting like this, and then we can see that we have alternatives. That's what she's trying to teach us. And I think that's why I'm drawn to all of these authors, because all of them, in different ways, are asking us to step back and become conscious of, how have we been programmed to live together in society, and do we really want to keep doing that? To look beneath the surface of events and say, what is the culture, what is the constructed reality or worldview that gives rise to the kinds of social institutions that we have, and the kinds of behavior that we see. So we have a certain kind of mass media, right? Journalism, whatever you want to say about it. That didn't just come up in a void. There's a whole inertia of culture that produced it. And that's what she wants us to do, is let's take a step back, look at the big picture, look deeper. Let's get more into that and see what she has in mind. But I want to get back to your question. In Chalice and the Blade, she says that some of the ideal societies of the time were on the island of Crete, Minoan Crete, Minoan. I don't know much about it myself, but she says that what shattered that partnership society was invasion by nomadic peoples from the steppes of Asia, who, because they were in such a harsh physical environment, they were struggling to meet their needs, and they went out in search of better lands to conquer or whatever. They came upon the Minoan Cretans and basically took over or infused that culture with their values. She says they resisted. It took centuries to completely change the culture, but that it came from outside. It came from invasion. I don't know enough of archaeology to contest that or to say whether that's, you know, that's a full explanation, but that's her interpretation. That if a human society is living in harmony with nature, if you have let's say a hunter-gatherer society, or even an agricultural society that's somewhat in balance with nature and people's needs are being met, that it's easier to have partnership values. But if things get harsh, if there's scarcity, if there really is a struggle to survive, then violence is going to be more likely. Right, so the counterexample there, even in a hostile physical environment, a culture makes the decision or is lucky enough to evolve in a way that it's not a violent culture.
Or it could be that...
...specific now and talk about the specific difference between a dominator and a partnership culture. She talks about four areas of culture or civilization. And one thing that she emphasizes more than maybe any other theorist, and this is part of her feminist analysis, she says that family and social structure are related, that what happens in intimate human relations is going to be writ large in society and vice versa, that they go together. So family and social structure are one portion of a culture. A dominator society will have an authoritarian structure. There will be hierarchies of domination. So you have easily identifiable guys at the top, men, usually men, because males are ranked above females. You have men at the top In the family, children grow up in punitive, male-dominated families. Inequality is the norm, right? You just accept the fact that some people will rise to the top and others will have to struggle. So there's a hoarding of goods and resources. That's a dominator society. A partnership society is more democratic, more flowing, more accepting of difference. There's not a rigid top-down structure. Now, she doesn't say that there's no structure. She talks about hierarchies of actualization, which means the people who are in authority or responsible for a family or for a tribe or for a company or for a country, they are not in it for their own power. They're in it to serve the common good. There's a whole literature now on servant leadership. And she says in a partnership culture, that's what leaders are. They take responsibility, they help the organization or the country or the tribe to thrive, but they're not expecting a disproportionate reward for that.
It sounds similar to like
partnership family. Parenting is authoritative but not authoritarian. She's not promoting letting kids do whatever they want. In her educational work, she's not using the anarchist free schools of the 60s as her model. That's not her ideal. There is structure. There is the wisdom of the elders, but it's not held in a punitive and an authoritarian kind of way. A second component of culture are gender roles. And in a dominator culture, you have a clear separation of male and female roles, with the male half ranked over the female. And that masculine traits are clearly distinguishable from female traits. So you have toughness and violence and conquest, those are males. And caring and softness and emotions, that's reserved for females. I can think of a good illustration of this from my study of American history. In the around the 1830s and 40s, when industrialization was starting to take hold in the U.S., there was a literature that emerged of advice, giving advice to families, because males were now having to go to work out of the home, go to work in industry and in the business world. And the advice they were given was, the business world is very tough, very very competitive, and the man is going to have to work hard and be aggressive and fight. So therefore, the woman should make sure that the home is very peaceful and nurturing, and it's the woman's job to comfort the man when he comes home from this tough world of business. So that was very explicit advice and very widely followed. The historians called it the cult of domesticity. That's what women had to do. So it falls right into Eisler's pattern here of a dominator culture saying, we don't want people equally to balance out aggression and nurturing. We want men to be aggressive and out in the world and women to stay home and be comforting. That's a hallmark of a dominator society. In a partnership society, the gender roles are more fluid, that both men and women can be tough when they need to be, can be caring and empathetic. Men should be able to take care of children. Women should have full participation in the economic world. And that men and women are valued equally. There's not a ranking. A third area of culture are economic and social relations. And again, she talks about this top-down control, so that economic institutions, political institutions are clearly ruled by the masters, the superiors. They have the authority. They have the right to use violence to keep the inferiors under control. Child beating, abuse of spouses, abuse of girlfriends, abusive behavior in the workplace, police forces run amok. These are all hallmarks of a dominator culture. A partnership culture is more concerned with taking care of everybody, not giving advantage to some few and then oppressing everyone else who threatens that advantage. There's much less violence because they're not trying to enforce a ranking, a hierarchy. It's allowed for people to rise in society, to claim an equal station. That's a partnership culture. And then the fourth component are narratives, the mythology or the stories or the symbols that a society uses to maintain its identity, really. So in a dominator system, our narratives justify and idealize domination and violence. A culture tries to teach people that this is just the way things are. People are naturally violent, and we have to protect ourselves. And so this is where you get into America's fascination with guns, the whole gun culture. If you ask a large percentage of the gun owners, why are you so determined to hold onto your guns? You know, why do they have to be pried out of your dead cold fingers, right? As Charlton Heston said, it's because I have to protect myself and my family from the government or from criminals. If only we would arm teachers, you know, we wouldn't have these school massacres, right? So this belief system is rooted in a cultural pattern. It's not just something that comes out of nowhere. The NRA didn't invent this way of thinking. It comes out of a cultural pattern that takes for granted human beings are naturally violent and you better protect yourself. Another example of cultural narratives, look at statues, look at who we put on our public, in our public parks. It's not teachers or healers or people who negotiate peace treaties, it's generals, right? It's George Washington and Andy Jackson and Robert E. Lee and
Andy Jackson.
Good old Andy Jackson. He's right there in the Jackson Square in New Orleans. He's right across the street from the White House, right?
Yeah, but then they've got
North America. I was 25, and my family went to Switzerland. And in Zurich, walking down the street, and there's a park, and there was a picture of Johann Pestalozzi, who was one of my heroes in educational history. He, during the Napoleonic Wars, he took in orphans and started a school for orphans and came up with a way of dealing with them that was really a foundation for alternative progressive education. So here's a statue to this guy in the middle of Zurich, and I said, wow, you don't have statues to people like that. So that's an example of how the culture teaches us who our heroes should be, what we should value. And obviously, the opposite, in a partnership system, you would have more statues of Pestalozzi and Montessori and John Dewey, and not so many of Robert E. Lee. And our whole mythology, our whole stories, the way we teach history. So what's important in history? Well, the battles, the wars, that's what drives society, right? Well, what about everything else? What about people living their everyday lives and how they interact in families and how we raise kids. And Eisler says that's really what makes a society what it is. The wars are part of it, to be sure. But why does our history dwell on that? Well, because we're a dominator culture, and the culture wants us to think that that's
going
to be boring. In our culture, we are conditioned to expect violence, to fear violence, and we're glued to it because we're fascinated by it, but we're afraid of it. We you get some sense of control if you can. We'll get to this a little bit later, but she says the United States has strong partnership values. If you look at the Declaration of Independence, all men are created equal and all the rest of that, there was an intention there to create a partnership society, but competing with that was the exploitation of the land, the violence against the native people, slavery. So the U.S. has this tension between our ideals and the culture that inhabited the continent. And unfortunately, the violent side usually wins out. So that's how it happens. But it's a constant choice. We can make the choice to have a different culture. I mean, those of us who are partnership-oriented are maybe in the minority right now and don't have the clout to make that change happen. But it is a tension. I mean, just speaking for myself, I don't watch TV news. You know, I'm sitting in my parents' living room and this garbage comes on, and I say, no, I'm leaving. I don't want to watch this. This doesn't speak to me. Or movies that are overly violent. It's like, that doesn't entertain me. I don't want to see that. So that's a choice I'm making. More people could make that choice. If we become aware of, wow, look at how this culture is conditioning us, I don't have to participate in that. So that's what she's trying to do, is make us more aware that we don't have to participate. All right, so she calls her approach cultural transformation theory, which implies that cultures do change, that you can make a decision to transform a culture. And she says you do that by looking at the totality of a social economic system, that you can find patterns in how humans relate to each other and relate to the earth that will play out in the family, in schools, in the economy, in politics, in the military, all of these, that they're all related. You're not going to have a dominator education system, but have a partnership economy. The culture as a whole will be committed to certain values on this continuum. So here's a quotation. She says, the cultural evolution of societies from prehistory to the present reflects the underlying tension between the partnership and domination systems as two basic alternatives for organizing how we think and live. These two systems structure our relations with one another and our natural environment and represent opposite ends of a spectrum of cultural possibilities. Cultures change. The issue is whether the change is surface change within an often unnamed assumptions of a dominator system, or transformative change that occurs at a systems level. Maybe I should paraphrase that. That's saying a lot. So let's just take the example that's right in our faces this week. So gun control, right? Let's say Congress would pass a miracle, right? We have gun control laws now. We're going to take away the guns from crazy people. And reduce the number of guns. She would say that's kind of a surface improvement. Sure, let's do that. But have you really addressed the culture of violence and entitlement and self-protection, all that goes with that. Have you addressed all that in the schools and in a competitive economy and everywhere else? That's what she wants us to look at. Not that we shouldn't try to improve things wherever we can, but you're not going to have deep or long-lasting effects. You're not going to change the culture unless you look at the underlying values of it. She says that this is a quote, the categories of partnership and domination transcend conventional ones, such as religious versus secular, East versus West, right versus left, and capitalist versus socialist. The degree to which a society orients to either end of the partnership domination scale affects all of our relations from intimate to international. So she points out that you can change your economic system. So you can have a socialist economy, but still have dominator values. And Soviet Union would be an example of that. You can have people on the left, people who are liberals and have wonderful ideals about human brotherhood and all that, but they can act very violently. They can shout down a right-wing speaker and throw things at them and prevent them from speaking, to take an example. So you can use dominator tactics in the service of humane values, because that's what the culture is teaching you. And there could be conservatives who are oriented to partnership values. So she's saying that. Yeah. So she's saying that this partnership, for her, this partnership domination dichotomy is really the basic one in understanding a culture. Now, we might contest that. You might say that's oversimplifying things. But the other authors we look at will have different ways of interpreting things, but that's her position. The Scandinavian countries, I think, are the best modern example. And she points to them as examples of more partnership-oriented societies where there's less violence, their economic system is more egalitarian, their gender roles are more open-ended. There's parental leave for fathers as well as mothers, for example.
But it is a very homogeneous society.
Yeah, make the case that makes it easier. I don't think she thinks that that's a big deal, though. It's really, I don't know, that could be a good discussion. Could you have partnership values? Well, is Canada an example of a very heterogeneous society that still has many partnership aspects compared to the U.S.? Dominator partnerships dichotomy is at the basis of understanding culture, she says, and the underlying basis of partnership and dominator are gender relations. The division of humanity into male and female is so foundational. We're aware of it from the earliest age. It provides what she calls a basic mental map for all other relations between people who are different.
So working on that would sort of
hatred of foreigners or other kinds of divisions. Not that it would all go away, but the habit of ranking humanity and saying, look, these differences are really important, and this part of humanity is clearly superior to this part. If you didn't have that in a gender sense, it wouldn't be as compelling in other ways.
But it's learned.
It's learned.
Wouldn't you say?
Here's how she characterizes a dominator culture. We will see more or less rigid systems of ranking social groups. She says a dominator paradigm is an integrated agenda designed to maintain rankings of domination, be they man over woman, parent over child, race over race, or man over nature. When people relate to each other as superiors and inferiors, they develop beliefs justifying these kinds of relations. They build social structures that mold relationships to fit this top-down pattern. To maintain rankings of domination, caring and empathy have to be suppressed and devalued, beginning in families and from there to economics and politics. So we don't want too much caring and empathy. Yeah.
Well, it's fantastic. I mean, it's in the White House. There it is.
Right. You have to dehumanize your inferiors in order to maintain that dominance. You have to, at some level, you have to believe, well, they really aren't as valuable as I am. They're not as worthy. So it's okay that I get paid more or I have a bigger house or whatever. She says, historically, our violent ways of child rearing come from a time when not obeying the orders of authoritarian chieftains, feudal lords, or kings could bring the most terrible torture, even death. So this upbringing was designed to produce people who would view relations of domination and submission as normal and natural. So once you're taught as a young child that you go out of line and you're going to pay for it, it's going to hurt, then as a citizen, you're going to stay within the lines unless you're able to rebel somehow. But that's what society wants you to do. Dominator child rearing teaches us to suppress our own needs and inclinations. You do what daddy says. You do what the king wants you to do, or what society wants you to do. Boys are taught that masculinity involves domination and violence, and girls are taught to submit and serve. Eisler says, in these cultures, we find a high degree of culturally accepted violence, from child and wife beating to violent scapegoating of outgroups and chronic warfare. Violence is customarily used by rulers to control their subjects and by men to control women. The socially accepted use of violence in intimate relations has been a training ground for habits of violence across the board. And it produces denial. It makes it hard for adults who are brought up this way to question, much less challenge, powerful economic interests on whom they feel dependent. So she says people want stability. They're looking out for their short-term needs. They don't want change. They don't want to upset the apple cart. So conservatism is enforced by this threat of violence, this fear. And she goes on to say that even religion, in a dominator culture, religion is based on fear, and that's how people are motivated. Now, she's not blaming religion as such, because in a partnership culture, you can have different type of religion. We talked about the Quakers before, right? So that's not based on fear, but that's a partnership way of thinking. She says, people who believe that top-down domination systems are the only option recognize the foundational importance of early human relations, so they make traditional family, traditional in quotation marks, a traditional family that is authoritarian, male-dominated, and highly punitive, a priority in their political agenda. So, you know, we see this with right-wing politics. All right, I've already covered this, talking about the tension between the American ideals and the cultures that gave shape to America. So she acknowledges that at certain periods in American history, but also in world history, even though there may be progress toward partnership ideals, there are periods of regression. And she uses this term regression a lot, where dominator values do get the upper hand for one reason or another. And she certainly acknowledges that that's what we're experiencing right now. But then she goes on to say that when you have a time of turmoil, when these values are really up for grabs, that's an open cultural space, and it provides an opportunity for significant change. So if we're not locked into our cultural assumptions and things are breaking down or things are being contested like they are today, that's the time to move in. That's the time to really press for the kind of changes we want, because things are unsettled. And she proposes what she calls an integrated progressive agenda. So the kind of political changes that we talk about, but also the changes in human relations and education and our stories, our narratives. Like, this is the time to put forward a partnership or a progressive agenda. It would involve ending violence against children and women, changing our whole system of education, changing our whole economy. And this is kind of the last area that I want to talk about in her work, what she means by a caring economy. So in 2008, she came out with a book called The Real Wealth of Nations. It's a kind of a pushback on Adam Smith and his Wealth of Nations. The real wealth of nations, she says, are the caring and caregiving functions that really enable us to survive. That she says that conventional economics is really only studying dominator economics. Remember when we talked about Wendell Berry? He says that contemporary economics is really all about the career of money as it goes around exploiting the earth. Eisler would agree with that. She says we're really only looking at money and exploitation of resources. We're not looking at the transactions between people that nurture us, that enable us to thrive. There's no monetary value put on that, and so it doesn't count. A free market ideology really is not about freedom and opportunity. It's about maintaining the current imbalance and privilege that certain groups have. We have a dominator economy right now, and the apologists for that economy talk about free market and lack of regulation, and they don't want things to change. They want to maintain their privilege. Now, on the question of technology, Eisler is somewhat different from Berry and some of the other people we're going to be reading. She doesn't have a problem with technology as such, and even says we don't want our standard of living to decline. We need our technology to maintain our standard of living. So in that sense, she is not a kind of deep ecological thinker that we're going to see with Derek Jensen next week. Or even Wendell Berry. She wants to live in harmony with nature and have a respectful attitude toward the natural world, but she's not too concerned about technology as such. There's no intrinsic reason that industrial technology needs to be destructive, she says. Within a partnership culture, we would use technology differently. We would respect nature and community. Because we live in a dominator culture, our technology takes on a speed and a power that it normally wouldn't have, that's out of sync with our natural rhythms. The economic system drives us into unhealthy lifestyles and relationships. So again, it's for her, it's the underlying values, it's not the technology itself. Our natural life support system is at risk because advanced technology and a dominator value system are a potentially lethal mix. The life supporting services of nature are as undervalued as the life supporting services of women. This mindset shapes economic rules, policies, and business practices. and further the conquest of nature, because that's our value. So she, in her economic writing, she talks a lot about the caregiving that traditionally women have provided. So caring for children, caring for elders. Remember that example of caring for your man when he comes home from a hard day at work. First of all, she doesn't want that to be just women's role. But beyond that, she wants the economy to recognize that those kinds of functions are valuable, even though we don't always put a price on it.
What does that mean?
So conventional economic models are leaving out these essential aspects of our lives, our relationships and caring. And so she proposes a caring economy that really is rooted in the ways we take care of each other. So she lists six ways that that this different kind of economy would show itself. It would include the full spectrum of human transactions, not just the flow of money. Two, partnership and not dominator cultural values would inform the entire system. So you wouldn't have such brutal competition, you wouldn't have such inequality, you wouldn't have such destruction of nature. Three, the rules, policies, and practices of business would support human needs, long-term concern, and caregiving functions. It wouldn't just be the bottom line of quick financial profit. I think we talked about this with Wendell Berry, right? That the current legal structure of corporations gives corporate managers the responsibility to make money for their shareholders. And if you make decisions that are good for the environment or good for your workers, but they lose money or cut into profits, your shareholders could turn on you and say you're not doing your job. She is saying, let's change that. And I think last week you talked about the B Corp.
Yeah.
Right? Yeah. So how we can actually have a legal structure that encourages caring and concern for long-term values and the health of a community. So she endorses that. We've already mentioned this, but let's use economic indicators that measure health and happiness, not just gross national product or an economic growth. Five, more participatory social structures. So the fact that corporations and political entities are governed so top down. She wants there to be more participation. So, for example, cooperative enterprises reflect partnership values, and we should have more co-ops in an economy and not so many top down organizations. The system should work for everyone, not just for those in power or those with the most wealth. And finally, she proposes an economic theory that's alternative to both capitalism and socialism, and she wants to call it partnerism. I don't know if that's going to catch on, but
not with the divorce rate the way it is.
Right. But that would change too in a partnership culture, maybe. But both capitalism and socialism can serve dominator values. So she wants to get out of that argument and say, let's have an economy, again, that serves communities, serves health, embraces everybody, and there might be elements of free enterprise and capitalism in that. There may also be elements of socialism, as in the Scandinavian countries. But let's not be hung up on which of those models. The important thing is that it's a caring economy. That's her main argument. And that's really all I've got to present on her.